Welcome everyone to Talking Shop Down Under. This is your host, Richard Banks. Welcome. And I have with me for this particular episode, Mr. Luke Drum. Luke, welcome.
Hello.
Hello. Okay, do you want to do an introduction of yourself very shortly and quickly?
Consultant type, spends a lot of time doing the C-sharp web and app thing. Also spends spare time doing games-related activities, teaching the youth about this wild and wacky world of software development.
Fantastic. Now, for the listeners' benefit, we're recording the introduction at the end of the show because, hey, that's how we roll. We actually ended up launching into what our topic was and getting underway without doing any of the preamble and formality. So with that in mind, let's go and cut all the way back to half an hour ago when we first started talking. Functional programming, let's start there.
Yeah, okay.
All right, so go.
Okay.
All right, okay, let's step it back a little bit. Is there enough functional programming goodness in C#/even VB.net these days to do all that we really need to do?
Okay, well, there is, but some of it's borrowed. So C# allows you to do some pretty sexy things that are kind of commonly associated with functional programming, things like closures and lambda expressions and things like that. But the kind of one piece that was a little slower to come to the party was the idea of immutable objects or immutable classes. And C#, courtesy of basically sharing the very same framework that F# does, now gains the wonderful ability to instantiate, create immutable classes.
How do we do that?
You basically piggyback on F#.
What, so I wrote my class in F# and then call it?
Basically.
That doesn't count. So... Okay, so what's the difference between me just doing a struct then?
Okay, so probably worth backtracking just a little bit and defining what immutability means.
Okay.
So how's that for a sophisticated response? So types of immutability.
We won't hold you up for that level of sophistication for the whole half hour. But
some people just, you know, are happy that I've got pants on and stop at that.
Yeah, I'm glad this is a voice-only podcast.
types of immutability. So we have the most common type of immutability that C# programmers probably come across, which is you've got a set of basically read-only fields.
Mm-hmm.
And that type of immutability is great, and it gets you by for a lot of situations, particularly when it's fairly simplistic, simple-threaded type code. Where it tends to fall down is when you're doing multi-threaded code and you start having to deal with locks and all of that kind of razzmatazz. And, yeah, it starts to get a little more difficult. Hop and skip a jump across to languages like F#. What they do is they default to a more serious type of immutability where you literally can only create read-only things by default, and if you want to make a change, you're basically taking a copy of that object, changing that copy as you create it, and then you keep on repeating that until you've solved whatever problem you're trying to solve.
So would that be less performant, though?
Well, that's the kind of interesting thing. If you
I know object creation is not expensive. It's fairly simple. It's just memory allocation, away you go, right? But still, if you can just change one element of an object versus creating a whole new instance of the object, surely that's a little bit nicer.
Yes. Whether it's performance that you actually notice is another thing entirely. And for that possible slight degradation in performance, you gain basically a boatload of scalability. So suddenly you can, grab your precious little bit of data and chuck it you know, every which way that you care for. And you don't have to worry about, you know, multiple threads, you know, getting in the way, overriding each other, doing all sorts of horrible, horrible things to your poor little class. When your data comes back, you can combine it, safe in the knowledge that, you know, it hasn't been severely broken. The other thing that you can do is send it on its merry way across the network, do what needs to be done, serialize it, send it back across the wire, and still be, you know, hunky-dory.
So the whole send it across the wire, that's kind of a, I mean, what's, you know, there's DTOs, right? So you're still going to do DTOs anyway. So the whole functional thing from that point of view seems to be a bit of a furphy, because if you're going to take an object, you don't want to send the entire thing across. You only want to send what's required, because of, you know, you send just the data you need for the UI and then get back what you want and end of story, right?
So if C-sharp programmers were doing nothing but sending DTOs between little compact bits of logic, then life would be grand. But that's not generally what tends to happen. You tend to read in, you know, giant, great big gulp of data, do a lot of manipulation, and particularly around areas like reference data and stuff like that, you tend to start sharing things around, which is, you know, good in an OO sense, but bad in a functional sense.
All right, so here's a slightly different take on it then. If functionally is so good...
Yeah.
Why is it not good?
Well...
because if it was so good, everyone would be using it.
That's so. Here's where I reference one of two Joels. So the
are
first.
Are we talking about the Mr. Pobar Joel?
Well, he comes later, but first, make reference to the more infamous Joel. We quickly journey across to the other Joel, which is Mr. Spolsky, who will no doubt irritate many people just through the mere mention of his name. But he has a rather okay piece that he wrote quite a few years ago now that basically talks about would a Java developer be able to, and I think his example was Google or someone like that, would a Java developer be able to come up with Google? And the kind of, central point of his waffling argument is that if the...
Because they don't understand MapReduce, they're therefore... limp-brained idiots.
Well, I was going to, you know, tart it up a little. No, it wasn't so much specifically MapReduce. It was more along the lines of understanding, you know, some of the central tenets of functional programming adds to your, you know, repertoire, your palette of interesting and wonderful brushes that you can use in your day-to-day architecture to produce, you know, hopefully the optimal result. If you know nothing about the world beyond, say, simple structured programming, aka, you know, GW Basic from 20 plus years ago, then, you know, your repertoire of problem solving techniques is probably going to be a lot more limited than someone who has a grasp of OO techniques, you know, pipeline, functional.
That's not an argument for functional programming, though. That's just an argument against being a monotreme.
Okay, so the argument for functional programming specifically, I suppose it's the approach that functional programming tends to adopt, or a lot of functional programmers tend to adopt when approaching a problem. And anyone who's fallen in love with Link, you know, that's getting very close to a functional language.
Especially when you look at the parallel versions of it.
Especially the parallel versions. And Link, you know, borrows quite heavily from the functional world, quite heavily with its construction through those weird and wonderful little things called monads and basis in category theory and all of that jazz.
You mentioned before, we're coming way back right at the start, you mentioned closures before, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain closures in a way that a largely procedural thinking person would understand?
With a closure, when we define something, let's call it a closure. When we define a closure, if X has got a value at the time when we define the closure, the compiler stroke interpreter actually remembers the value of X, so that when we come to actually execute that code, it'll, you know, basically add it as if it had been run, you know, at the time when you first declared it. So it, all that closures really are at the end of the day is basically a nice bit of syntactic sugar to remember the state of play when you first defined the anonymous delegate.
So it's a anonymous delegate
that remembers that
refers to a variable outside of itself.
Yep.
But the value in that variable is going to change at runtime. We don't know what it could be. It could be just be a parameter passed into the method the delegate's defined in, right?
Well, that's the wonderful thing about closures. They basically essentially are taking a copy of the environment or taking a snapshot of the environment at that point in time. Now, where the theory becomes a little kind of skew-if is in when you start to mix in objects into the equation, you know, like C-sharp does.
Mm-hmm.
So if what you're relying upon is an object and you've fiddled around with the properties of that object since you created the closure, then yes, it will be basically a live instance of the object. But if you're dealing with what closures generally tend to get used for most, which is value types, you know, where it's essentially taking a copy, then yes, you've got a snapshot. Closures tend to really be capturing parameters, if you like, without it's really just a nice way to capture parameters without the legwork. No, that's really a bad that's a terrible, terrible reason. I feel ashamed and I shall wander outside right now. As an aside, you know how that footage of the lady falling into the fountain has been garnering press? So I've had...
This is the one that was looking at their supposedly smartphone, right?
Yes. Well, the phone was smart. If it was smarter, it would have, you know, ejected with a little parachute just milliseconds before it fell in, but it's not that smart. Anyway, so I've replicated a similar trick twice, the most recent one being coming back from my little 3G wander through the park where I walked into the back of Cheryl's car. The other time was when I walked into a cow, which is another story entirely.
What?
You even ever walked into the side of a cow?
So you were sitting there busily, what, reading your tweet streams, and you wandered out of urban Sydney and into a paddock in the countryside and walked into a cow?
No, it was even more embarrassing than that. It was back in high school days. Imagine a boarding school literally in the middle of nowhere, and I'm toddling from school back to the dorms, and there's no light about. There's no, you know, artificial light, and the moon has long since disappeared, and I'm basically trekking along in complete and utter darkness. And I just casually wander into the side of a cow, and we both kind of go, you know, shocked, give our respective apologies, and move their lives.
Oh dear. <Yeah. laughs> So I've got to apologize to everyone listening to this. This is going to be one of those bizarre episodes.
Anyway, as you were.
games industry.
Okay.
So all this functional doozy what's it stuff that everyone's so in love with but no one ever really uses in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
Games industry, they don't do anything with it, do they? Surely not.
The kind of interesting thing is that the games industry suffers at the hands of multi-threaded badness a lot more than a lot of business apps. So while they haven't found the perfect, you know, language and environment and mix to solve that for them, it kind of comes up more than what a lot of people would expect. A lot of people imagine the games industry to be a bunch of, well, these days C++ developers hiding away in a basement somewhere doing fantastic stuff that in no way is related or relies upon, you know, the mere mortal frameworks that the rest of us enjoy. But the reality is that...
Sweatshop.
Well, that too. The reality is they not only enjoy the worst of the software industry, as in tight deadlines...
Ridiculous overpromising of scope.
By salespeople, all of those type of things. But they also tend to be required to push machines to their very limit, and really there's no way to push a modern machine to its very limit without, you know, getting more than one thread involved. And, you know, hilarity ensues as, you know, things break down in the bowels of some sophisticated gaming engine library. And, you know, the debugging effort tends to make people who didn't enjoy it the first time in like 1978 to cry a little on the inside as they spend their weekends at 3 a.m. doing it again, except, you know, with more impressive terms like DirectX and OpenGL being thrown around.
I know we just talked ridiculous deadlines and everything else, but
yes.
Duke Nukem Forever doesn't follow that trend, does it?
So that's an exercise in business management. In fact, that's an exercise in project management. You know how Microsoft offers a certification in architecture? Well, the people involved in selling Duke Nukem for the last, how long has it been in development? 15 years? So whoever has been securing the funding for that has to be getting themselves certification from practically every software house. That's just project management taken to the extreme.
So as a complete aside, are you going to be buying a copy come May 3rd?
Tough call. I really enjoyed it as like as a kid, but that was when
when we were all playing Wolf 3D.
That's when I thought Duke Nukem had a sophisticated script because it swore. Oh, and it had partial nudity, which in awesome 2D billboard 1980s technology was – oh, sorry, 1990s.
Come on, it wasn't 80s. It was 90s.
Early 90s was just absolutely enthralling.
How can they get so many textures on so many pixels? I just don't understand. Anyway, so back to where we were threading, not Duke Nukem.
Yep.
If you were writing an MMO, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking not so much the front end, but the back end and the network stack and all those sort of things.
Yep.
Given where technology is at the moment and things like, say, Node.js, for instance, with the no lag IO and everything else, would that be a path you'd follow? Node with maybe Clojure or something like that? Clojure, I should say. Or would you do something on the .NET stack, or would you be looking at something completely different?
Well, there's a few things that have been put into practice. The guys who produce EVE Online, mm-hmm. that big multiplayer space doohickey, as it's referred to in the press.
300,000 plus concurrent users.
So they use, I'm probably going to call it incorrectly, it's called, I think, something like threadless Python, stateless Python. Whatever it's called, what they basically did is my understanding of it is they grabbed your regular Python interpreter and basically slightly bolted on, slightly gutted the underlying infrastructure of it so that it represented something that was a lot closer to languages such as Erlang. Which
Stackless Python.
Stackless Python, that's the one. So stackless Python.
How does stackless Python work? That's no stack.
What? Just pure.
Sorry, I'm having my head done in at the moment. How do you not have a call stack? Is that what it's talking about? I'm reading online as we talk, so keep talking. No elevator music.
Okay, so stackless Python, the details aren't the important thing. that's my common motto in all development, by the way. So stackless Python, what they're effectively doing in a similar way to Node.js and Erlang and, you know, all of these high throughput type environments is really trying to cut down on basically state getting fouled up by, you know, other bits of state on multiple threads. So in the case of Erlang, it's through this funky messaging type infrastructure. Node.js, I haven't played with enough to understand how it ticks behind the scenes, but yeah, usually it tends to be, there's only a few ways to skin this cat. And really what it boils down to is what they do is they, dare I say it, take a vaguely functional approach to life, which is they try and contain the amount of state down to the bare minimum. So they're sending around these little packets of state, and they try and set it up so that at any particular point in time, there's only one thread dealing with a bit of data. And so that they never get into, they basically engineer themselves out of the need to lock any bit of data because, you know, there's never more than one thread trying to consume a bit of data.
Okay, so that, I'm just trying to get my head around this a little bit. That would imply, if I've got 300,000 users online, well, they wouldn't all be on one server, physical server, obviously. They'd be farmed out. But in Eve, it's effectively, it's treated as one big server. But it's kind of, it's semi-sharded, right? So you move from one region to another, and there's this seamless transfer of a server. Would that be happening behind the scenes or something else?
That's basically what they do. They, from memory, EVE Online has some stupidly large amount of memory per server and this ridiculously large and fast, you know, database stroke disk array hiding away in the corner. And as you progress through the galaxy, what you're effectively doing is transferring between servers. The thing that saves EVE Online in a lot of respects is that they've created some game narrative to hide that transition between servers. What you do when you transition a bit between servers in EVE Online is go through this warp gate type thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a few seconds of pretty animation and it's all, you know, lovey-dovey and good. And you
get thrown across the network in the back end. What's actually getting sent up the wire are these very small bits of state as well, right, to the client?
In the case of EVE Online, yes, it's basically lots and lots of little independent vertical streams of data. In the case of Second Life, they take a very non-functional approach and they actually serialize the state of the .NET environment itself, which is a funky little thing. So they use the Mono runtime, and they basically wrote some very nice, albeit regular IL, which, believe it or not, saves the state of the currently executing, you know, class or, you know, graph, serializes it down to data. They send it across the wire and it rehydrates it on the, you know, on the virtual stack. And kicks it off again. It's a very funky bit of .NET code. They didn't have to modify the Mono runtime at all, basically, to achieve it, is my understanding.
So they just added their own little bit that kind of is effectively an aspect or something, is it? Not knowing behind the scenes, it's kind of hard to guess, but
from my understanding, it actually is more akin to calling a regular function, and that function just happens to, you know, do funky IL stuff.
So if one of the other things that would come to mind, obviously, with all this is if you've got servers running, you need to be able to save that data somewhere so that should the power drop, you don't lose all the accounts that everyone's had created. And, you know, you need to take the thing down for maintenance. You don't want to lose everyone's details because you will end up with a whole lot of angry users saying, I will never play this game again. You killed me.
That's kind of one of the other funky things about writing games as opposed to, you know, financial institutions and their banking and stuff like that, is that games actually have a lot more leeway in terms of what actually needs to be saved should the power get cut. Now, in most of those big MMOs, what you won't find is every single action that the user takes written immediately to disk. They're not killing some poor, you know, SQL server in the back room through having 300,000.
So they'd be doing what, inventory changes?
Keeping
track of death events, I suppose, and some of those sort of things, and then movement every 10 meters or something.
It depends
on whatever it happens to be.
In the case of things like EVE Online and Second Life, they actually basically just keep it in memory and, you know, every, I don't know, few minutes, then record, you know, take a snapshot and record that off to the database. So the databases only work as hard as they want them to work. You know, those actions that do actually need to be recorded, like fake or virtual financial transactions, people, even in a financially, well, weird and wonderful economy like the Second Life economy, there's not actually that many of them happening on any particular server at any one time. So it's, they basically can record at their leisure.
When you're on various MMOs, you move between regions, right?
Yep.
So you're playing, you switch from, you know, region X to region Y. That would effectively be a switch of a thread, potentially. So your state would transition from one thread to another. A thread would run a region for just...
Most commonly, yeah, they tend to be entire machines. Hardware is, you know, ridiculously cheap. So
even though it looks like you connect to one server...
In reality, you're usually connecting to a farm, particularly for games, you know, the big popular games, but even the smaller MMOs. When you connect to a particular region, what you're actually connecting to is a machine within a farm.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of games like World of Warcraft, they actually have the added complication of wanting to keep the narrative, you know, pretty strong, irrespective of how advanced a player you are.
Mm-hmm.
So players who've just started in the game see the world in, you know, basically its new, fresh look, you know, with things in a particular state. Meanwhile, you've got more advanced players who've, you know, might exist in a very different world. Well, the latest update from Blizzard
is Cataclysm.
Cataclysm is a graphic example of that, where the world is kind of half destroyed and so forth. And that kind of change needs to all exist within one region. So, yeah, you've got different servers basically running essentially not so much different versions of the code base, but different parts of the story. And... you know, as people move between regions, you know, you move between, servers and, yes.
Okay, so that functional approach to managing state and everything else comes into its own again there, that which is what Eve has done, obviously.
Yeah, I suspect probably the more interesting takeaway from games isn't the functional portion of it, but how they tend to split up the work on actually producing the game. So that whole rant and rave.
Yeah, so then taking that to a more boring business app or a highly scalable app, I suppose, more than anything else, you're taking the same approach. Or you can take the same, not you will, but you could take the same approach where you're sharding your logic, I suppose.
Yes, and in the case of things like, once again, picking on Erlang, that sharding becomes relatively easy because the infrastructure allows you to take overusing the term, but a very kind of functional approach where you've got basically, yeah, these vertical streams of data happening rather mm-hmm. than great big nests of state slowly infesting their way through your system. Visualization.
Oh, you're making me think of those skin cancer ads. that thing launches into your bloodstream and... that's wonderful.
State is your machine trying to tell you that you're suffering a horrible, horrible ailment.
Howdy. All right. We should probably wrap it there, actually, given our long and rambling road, and I've got to edit this thing. So before we close, DDD Sydney is coming back. Developer, developer, developer. So if you go to dddsydney.com, you will get a link. Well, you won't get a link because that is the link. You'll get a page which says, please register. So if you're interested, then head yourself over there and jump in, because last year's DDD was excellent fun. And it's happening again in Melbourne as well. But the Sydney one, I think, is going to be – looks like it's aiming for May 2011. So register to be a speaker or not, and then keep an eye on the site, because then there'll be sessions up and you can vote on them and everything else. And that's the plug I promised to give on behalf of – those who are organizing it. All right, so we'll call it wrapped. And thank you everyone for putting up with our rambling effort tonight. And with that in mind, feel free to leave feedback, suggest proper speakers other than either of us, and any topics you want talked about, and we'll catch you on the next episode of Talking Shop Down Under. And until then, happy coding. Catch you later.